All right, welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live on this Thursday morning. The conversation around cryptocurrencies and where they fit into traditional portfolios has continued through this year. Certainly the IPO or the direct listing of Coinbase brings a lot more focus, even increased focus, into public markets and how to think about cryptocurrencies. Last week's fundraise from FTX bringing even more capital into the space. Joining us now to discuss everything happening in the cryptocurrency space, Tom Jessup, the president at Fidelity Digital Assets. Tom, thanks for jumping on with us this morning. I'd love to start with just how you at Fidelity are thinking about this moment in cryptocurrency adoption. And from your vantage point as one of the largest traditional money managers, where crypto fits into the firm's thinking.
Yeah, nice to be with you this morning. So yeah, we see steady interest in adoption and really the emergence of this space as an asset class. Every year, we survey a large number of institutions globally, and we look at a time series of how they think about the space year on year. We've done this for 3 years. And what's apparent are two things. This is seen as its own unique asset class with its own fundamental drivers, which differ from other financial assets. We see clients digging into those issues and really understanding not only the technology, but the application of those assets in their portfolios. And maybe most importantly, what we're seeing is continued purchase interest over a longer period of time. Something like 70% of respondents to the survey this year intend to have an allocation to digital assets over the next 5 years. And this is a cross-section of institutions ranging from family offices and hedge funds all the way through to much more traditional institutions. So we continue to see slow and steady interest and progress towards bringing this asset class mainstream.
And Tom, you talk about interest in owning more crypto assets or digital assets over the next 5 years. What is the hang up for a lot of folks you talk to at this point? Is it custody? Is it being able to explain it to their clients? What's giving folks pause, I should say, at this point?
It's funny. There's certain things where I think as an industry, we've resolved the issues. So around the state of the market infrastructure, institutional service providers, whether it's from a custody or trading standpoint, I think we've done a good job of addressing those issues. A couple of years ago, there were concerns around, is there enough liquidity in the market? Are there enough service providers that understand my need as an institution? And the answer now is yes. We continue to see a few sticky concerns that investors have. One is clearly volatility. The other is, interestingly, what is the fundamental framework to value some of these assets? And it's interesting because in some cases, investors are putting a traditional lens onto an asset class that has an entirely unique and different set of fundamental drivers. And then interestingly, and also, well, maybe not so interestingly, regulation and regulatory clarity still is an issue for many investors who want to make sure there's a sound footing of regulation or at least a direction of travel before they commit significant assets to the space.
And Tom, on the regulatory front, how concerning were the comments this week from Gary Gensler to you?
I don't think they were specifically concerning. I think we need regulatory clarity. I think, yes, investor protection is an issue. Bringing this asset class up to the level of, the standard for stocks and bonds and other assets that investors purchase, that's important. And I don't think there's anyone in the ecosystem that would say that's a bad thing. Certainly based on our research, it's a good thing. The question is, what happens from here and at what pace? So we think the attention is positive, even though there may be some concerning things that are said from time to time. But we and others are very engaged with regulators and continue to educate them on ways to bring this asset class into the mainstream and into a regulatory framework that captures a lot of the principles that apply to other asset classes, but importantly, focusing on the unique attributes of this asset class, where emphatically, there are no historical analogs for perhaps how to apply these regulations to what is essentially a new financial technology.
What would a fair regulatory framework look like to you?
It's a good question. I mean, clearly, let's just talk a little bit about what's going on this week. So with the infrastructure bill and some of the language in that bill, I think, being clear about reporting and, again, standards that apply to other asset classes is important. But there's some unique language that talks about including folks that are effectively service providers, miners and other node validators into that reporting framework. And that doesn't necessarily achieve the same the appropriate objective. So we and others are working with regulators to try to straighten that out. But I think it's the same standards of investor protection, transparency, the things that have made the U.S. and global capital markets liquid and accessible to all investors, applying the same principles to digital assets, but again, taking into account some of the unique attributes of the technology.
And Tom, switching gears a little bit, I want to just talk about what you guys are doing at Fidelity in terms of beefing up this specific group. I mean, you know, you worked at Goldman Sachs for a long time, made the move over to the crypto space, I think, what, 4 or 5 years ago. And it feels like the hot new thing. And really, as you know, you go through the IB program, you say, what am I going to do next? It feels like crypto is now part of that conversation for folks who want to be, you know, in markets and thinking about, you know, kind of banking and finance longer term.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the emergence of, you know, we tend to think of this technology at a base level as a new operating system for financial assets or certain financial assets. And our intent to grow in the space and provide customers with access to these products is a long-term proposition. We think it's it will be core to our business and all of our client segments over the longer term. So call it current price activity notwithstanding, we continue to invest in building out an infrastructure that will allow us to be nimble and innovate and deliver services to our clients who want access to this new asset class.
All right, we'll leave it there. Tom Jessup, president at Fidelity Digital Assets. Tom, thanks so much for jumping on this morning.
Let's drill down into these markets with Simona Paravani-Mellinghoff. She is BlackRock's Global Chief Investment Officer of Solutions and joins us now. Simona, good to see you on this morning. Give us with your latest market thoughts here, your latest views on the markets here. As I mentioned, we are seeing some pressure in pockets of tech. Where are you thinking markets could go next?
Well, first of all, thank you for the invite and good day from rather cloudy London. I do actually have to look outside the window to check the weather because it's even more volatile than the market. It's quite interesting that the level of volatility that we are seeing in the market is such that makes the performance feel somewhat less positive than what one would conclude by literally just looking at the number of performance year to date. I mean, year to date, most markets are in positive territory. If we look at US equities or continental European equities, we are talking of gains year to date in excess of 15%. And even in fixed income space, we have segments like high yields that are definitely in positive territory. So it's interesting to dig a little deeper in what is driving the volatility. And I would say that that's largely the result of the questions on two very important fronts. On one side is growth, on the other is inflation. And to dig a little bit deeper, starting with growth, the fundamental question for investors right now is the extent to which the impact of new variants like Delta may indeed have a meaningful impact on economic growth and on inflation. Of course, we have seen elevated readings in the U.S. The CPI number, for example, was actually one of the highest since 2008. And this has led investors to ask themselves the question of whether this would be the beginning of a more permanent shift that would then result in the Fed having to tighten more aggressively. Needless to say, the answer to this key two questions, what's the outlook for inflation and what's the outlook for growth, is the absolute key component of any view on markets and therefore portfolio positioning.
And, you know, Simona, it's interesting that you bring up how much anxiety it seems there is in the markets, given that returns, pretty much everything, have been stellar so far this year. And we talked about this theme a lot last year when I would ask folks, you know, why is everyone unhappy with the S&P up 40% from the low, so on and so forth. And I guess at this moment, I'm reminded again, is it still maybe a bit of a hangover from the financial crisis where we waited year after year for the next shoe to drop? And, you know, all the market did until the pandemic was basically go up and to the right in a straight line.
I think it's fair to say, and I'm about to state the obvious, that we live in fairly uncertain times. And to rephrase George Orwell, all the future is always uncertain, but some parts of the future are more uncertain than others. And I would say that in particular right now, we have this uncertainty on growth and on inflation. And on growth, our central scenario remains one where we see growth being buoyant for this year and possibly beyond, even though we acknowledge that the emergence of new variant is a risk factor in the short term. But the central scenario is for positive growth. And this is also confirmed by some of the positive readings that we are seeing around PMI this week. And this is really underpinned by two key components. On one side is the policy framework that remains largely still positive, and on the other is actually the pent-up demand that effectively, the moment we see the economies reopen, we see that pent-up demand materializing. I think what is perhaps unique in terms of the current bouts of volatility and feeling, and I'm using the term feeling of uncertainty, is perhaps the inflation picture, because that is a departure somewhat from what we have experienced since the financial crisis.
And, you know, Simone, I wanted to ask also about the U.S. versus the rest of the world. You mentioned that, you know, in certain markets, the performance has still been okay, but the growth trajectory in the U.S. certainly been a little bit more aggressive than we've seen in the rest of the world. I mean, do you think investors are just believing that eventually we will have a catch-up in terms of an overall economic growth, or is the U.S. enough to kind of power us through the early part of this cycle?
I think it's fair to say that most developed economies, particularly those where we are seeing good patterns around vaccination level, are really on a positive trajectory when it comes to economic growth. So I would say it's largely a global story. And let's not forget that both the fiscal and monetary policy responses have been quite aggressive and not just in the U.S.
All right, we'll leave it there. BlackRock Global Chief Investment Officer of Solutions, Simone Parravani-Mellinghoff, good to see you.
Thank you.
Another strong quarter for Viacom CBS on the streaming front. The company said second quarter global streaming sales rose 92% from a year ago as it added 6.5 million new subscribers. Joining us now to discuss is Viacom CBS CFO Naveen Chopra. Naveen, welcome back. Always good to speak with you here. Walk us through these streaming numbers here. Why do you think you were able to gain so many subscribers to the extent you did?
Yeah, thanks for having me back. Good to see you again, Brian. As you said, Q2 was a really strong quarter for us. I think it's fair to say the business is firing well across multiple dimensions. But streaming was really the standout, both on the subscription side of the business, where we added 6.5 million subscribers, led by Paramount Plus, but also on the advertising supported side of our streaming business, which is led by Pluto TV, continues its rocket ship trajectory, going to do over $1 billion of revenue in that business this year. And the trajectory in both of those is really a function of expanded content, really starting to diversify what we make available across Paramount Plus, Showtime, Pluto TV. There's a big component of it that is about global expansion, and also some real strength in digital advertising sales. So when we've been able to put all that together, the streaming business grew 92% in Q2. So we're really proud of that. But, you know, the other traditional parts of our business are also doing very well. We saw 9% growth in our affiliate business, 24% growth in our advertising business. So great momentum and a lot more to come.
Specifically on Paramount Plus, Naveen, how many subscribers do you have? And just based on the response, do you think you're now at the point where you could push through a price increase or two?
So our global subscriber base for Paramount Plus is now hitting 42 million. Not just for Paramount Plus, for our broader streaming portfolio. We do think that's a meaningful level of scale. And we're very optimistic about the ability to grow ARPU over time, both through evolution of price as we expand our content portfolio. But also, remember, there's an advertising component to that. And we saw ARPUs in that side of the business grow very nicely in Q2. And we think there's more of that ahead. So we're very optimistic about where we can go from a pricing and ARPU perspective.
Naveen, it's Miles here. And coming back to, you know, what you guys saw on the ad side, certainly it was an interesting quarter in that you lapped, you know, on the sports portfolio, at least you lapped a quarter where there kind of was nothing in Q2 of 2020. And I'm curious what that environment looked like as we went through this second quarter's sporting events, and then also how you guys are seeing, you know, an NFL season that I think we're all expecting will be, you know, pretty much like 2019, and what your partners are saying about that.
Yeah. Well, as you said, it's been an interesting year because there's been a lot of movement in the timing of events, including some events that are very big from an advertising perspective. But the thing we're focused on is the fact that audiences are still coming back to these events from a viewership perspective, both in linear and on our streaming platforms. That's very exciting for us. We're also looking forward to getting the benefit of a very strong upfront that we had this year, and that'll start to kick in Q4. You know, we'll be able to pair that with some really exciting content that we're bringing to our streaming platforms, both Paramount Plus and Showtime. You mentioned the return of things like NFL football. That should be big for us. We'll have Champions League back on in the fall. We'll have some great movies coming to the service, some new scripted content. So we think all of those things together will be some really powerful drivers.
Going through the divisions, Naveen, the operating profits in TV entertainment, the cable networks and film segments, they were down on an adjusted basis as you invest in your business, notably streaming. Do you think you have reached peak investing as it pertains to streaming?
Yeah, so there's a couple things. Number one, relative to last year, there's some comps you got to adjust for. We had a very big deal with for licensing at South Park in 2020 that doesn't repeat. But the broader point, as you noted, is about streaming investment. And we see a massive opportunity in streaming as you're seeing the growth, both in terms of subs and revenue. And we think it makes a ton of sense to continue to invest behind that. We've said that we intend to double the amount of streaming content investment in 21 relative to 2020. And we're starting to see the fruits of that. We're ahead of our plan in terms of growth around subs and revenue. And we're going to continue putting fuel in the tank to take that even further. It's just a tremendous opportunity, and we're going to be a big part of it.
And Naveen, on the theater side, finally starting to see, you know, some returns to theaters there from releases. How are you guys thinking about that part of the business, and how optimistic are you that we can start to talk about box office type levels, you know, that would have been familiar to the industry as we get into the second half of this year?
Yeah, as you said, films are very important to Viacom CBS, and we launched our first theatrical release, A Quiet Place Part II. Since the start of the pandemic, in the through theaters, did very well there, and then we brought it to Paramount Plus 45 days later, where it's also been a big acquisition driver. So we think movies will continue to add a lot of value for the company, both in the theatrical channel and on our streaming platforms. We don't think it's a one-size-fits-all model, by the way. We think we've got movies that are ideally suited for theatrical release, and we've got other movies that work really well in streaming, and then we've got movies that work in both. And you'll see us take advantage of all of those channels going forward. I mentioned A Quiet Place Part II. In August, we're going to be releasing Paw Patrol in theaters and then also simultaneously on Paramount Plus. And then we've had movies like Infinite, which is a thriller that we released exclusively on Paramount Plus. And it was very successful from an acquisition and an engagement perspective. So we're really looking forward to being able to marry the slate that we got coming in the back part of this year and next year with all of those distribution channels that are available to us.
And Naveen, I'm sure you're watching the situation over at Disney and with Black Widow and Scarlett Johansson. And a lot of folks in the industry are very much focused in on this. You know, you have simultaneous releases, streaming and theatrical. Do you and your team have to go back and rethink how talent is compensated and how much, in fact, they are compensated?
Yeah, so, you know, as I mentioned, we have multiple models for releasing movies, and the key for us is to look at those things on a title-by-title basis. And as we do that, and as we make the decision about what is the optimal channel or combination of channels for releasing any particular title, we do it with an eye to all of the constituents that are involved. Those relationships that we have with talent truly are paramount for us. And we care deeply about those, and we're committed to having open dialogues with all constituents as we make decisions to maximize the value of content.
And lastly, real quickly, before I let you go, doing the math, you have about $9 billion in total liquidity between cash and an undrawn credit facility. How do you plan to use that cash moving forward?
That's right, Brian. And actually, that's going to get even bigger later in the year when we close the sale of Simon & Schuster, which should happen later this year, subject to regulatory review. That'll put another $2 billion of cash on the balance sheet. And as we've said, we love having that kind of firepower. Our number one priority is to invest in streaming. You can see the success that we're having there. So you'll see us continue to do more of that. And then I think we've also got, you know, a very balanced view of continuing to return some capital to shareholders through our dividend and managing leverage on our balance sheet. So, but streaming is a just such an exciting opportunity with great momentum. That's definitely our first priority.
It's a great place to be in. We'll leave it there. Viacom CFO Naveen Chopra, always good to see you. Have a good rest of the week.
Thanks for having us.
We've got a new entry on the NASDAQ today. The European Wax Center raising $180 million in its IPO, listing under the ticker EWCZ. And we saw shares just begin trading a short time ago. The stock getting a big pop on the day, up about 13% after the Texas-based company priced shares at $17 each. That's about in the middle of its range. Let's bring in the CEO of the European Wax Center. We've got David Berg. And David, perfect timing. We heard all the cheers behind you as those shares began trading. I imagine you, like so many companies, are really seeing a healthy bounce back right now after what was a really slow period during the pandemic. Talk to me about the timing of the IPO, why you wanted to get out in front here and go public.
Sure. We're the leader in the industry, always have been, since our founders started the business back in 2004 and really professionalized the out-of-home waxing category. It was just a logical next step for us. We made the right investments in terms of our human capital, our infrastructure, that really allows us to take the next step as a public company. And it does a couple of things for us. We talk about instilling unapologetic confidence for our guests. And this is another confidence builder for us as the brand, for our associates, to make sure that we attract and retain the greatest associates that we have already, to our franchisees who deliver services every single day to delight our guests, and finally, to continue to give our guests confidence to keep coming back to the leader in the industry.
You know, I'm not going to present myself as a waxing expert here, but I will kind of talk about the numbers. And I'd love to get your take on kind of the growth that you're seeing. As you guys point out in your prospectus here in the S1 filing, you had increased net revenue from 2016 to 2019. We'll use pre-pandemic numbers here. 107 million to 154, CAGR of 13%. But we talk about the seasonality of this business too, kind of in the summers and holidays. What can you do to maybe broaden out the growth beyond those? And is that just kind of systematic to, I guess, the waxing industry?
Yeah, really modestly seasonality. A little bit more in the summertime as folks get ready for the beach, and a bit of a pop at holidays. But generally speaking, very, very smooth throughout the four quarters of the year. We're really focused on two things. How do we continue our thoughtful growth and adding units across the United States? And similarly, how do we just continue to drive same-store sale comps as we continue to delight guests every time they come in, every center, with every waxing experience? So it's a very straightforward and focused growth plan for us as we go forward.
Yeah, on that growth, you've got more than 800 locations already across the U.S. We're all familiar with the services in these stores, but I wonder what other channels of revenue you're looking to build on through products, for example. What do you see in your future on that front beyond the services?
Yeah, so we're going to stay focused. We are the experts in wax, champions in confidence, and we're going to stay focused on that. And that was really what our founders believed in, making waxing the star of the show. So we don't believe that we have to go far afield from that. We're going to go where our brand gives us permission and where our guests give us permission to play, and that's in all things wax. So you mentioned the retail products. They're 31 SKUs. They're proprietary to us, our recipe. And these are products that enhance the service, that add to the efficacy of the waxing experience. So we don't sell body wash and shampoos. We actually sell those products that are going to make your experience that much better.
David Berg, CEO of European Wax Center. Congratulations on the listing today. Appreciate the time. Let's turn our attention to another stock that has been a big mover in the session. Shares of Moderna down now, but it did hit a new high in the session after beating on the top and bottom lines in the second quarter. The company saying this morning its COVID-19 vaccine booster shot produced a robust immune response against three variants, including the highly contagious Delta variant in its phase two trial. For much more on this, let's bring in the CEO of Moderna, Stéphane Bancel. He's also joined by our very own Anjali Kamlani. Stéphane, it's always good to talk to you. You know, there's a lot of people today who got the Moderna shot who are asking themselves, you know, how much longer can this vaccine sort of perform against this surge in the Delta variant? How should we be thinking about the efficacy of it sort of 6 months on from rollout in the timing of a potential booster shot come fall?
Yes, so good morning and thank you for having me back. So it's a complicated scientific question. There's a few components. The first one is duration. I think the great news from this morning for people who got the Moderna vaccine or for people that are thinking about getting the Moderna vaccine is we saw that the efficacy really holds very nicely versus what we communicated. If you remember back in the fall, we communicated around 94% efficacy at the time. That's the data we had. And now if you look at the data through 6 months, we're holding very nicely at 93% efficacy, and that's going to be the final cut of the data as we file the BLA. We started filing the BLA on a rolling basis in May, and we communicated this morning that we're on track to finish the full filing in August this month. And so I think the duration looks really good, most probably the best vaccine in the world. Then the next question is variant, because of course the virus has evolved away from the original virus. You don't have all the antibodies that you need because of a mutation on that virus. But the good news with vaccines is you don't make one antibody. You make a soup of antibody. And so you get a very broad protection. What we've shown is we believe that over time, boosting is going to be important. The great news is we've tested a lot of boost in the clinic, including boosting with the same vaccine that is available today in pharmacies in the U.S., and the great news is that at even half the dose of the initial vaccine, we're getting incredible boosting. If you look at the antibody level after the second dose versus antibody level in the clinical study after the third dose, against the Delta variant, we got 42x increase in antibody, 42x, not 42%. And so it's a very positive surprise for the world. And so I think that if you think about it, a bit like with other vaccine, like, you know, the flu vaccine that you need an annual shot, I think boosting is going to be important to keep those antibodies level high and to keep adapting your antibody response to the currently circulating virus. And so as soon as a vaccine booster is authorized by the FDA, I want my third dose because I want to be able to spend a very nice winter and not be sick.
Hopefully, we'll definitely get to do that. Stéphane, good to talk to you again. I want to pull back from the boosters and let's talk about just the initial rollout for some countries in the world. The World Health Organization calling on a moratorium of boosters in wealthier countries in order to help the rest of the world catch up with the first round, at least for September. We just got word from Reuters that Israel, Germany, and France are going to continue their booster programs. I wonder, do you have any thoughts on sort of what your role is in helping the World Health Organization reach this goal and enforcing a sort of moratorium? And is there anything you can specifically do as a company? They've called on the producers to do so as well.
Yes, it's a very good question. And it's a big challenge that we're facing as a world because every government has a mandate and wants to protect their citizens. So we cannot do much as a manufacturer because if, you know, a country that you mentioned wants to use the current vaccine on hand, for which we shared the, you know, boosting per dose data, that is, again, the 42 times increase of antibodies versus after the second dose, we can do nothing to stop them. The vaccines are in their warehouse. We have legal commitment to ship the current vaccine because we don't know as a company if it goes toward vaccinating people that have never got vaccinated or boosters. It's really, I think, a discussion that needs to happen between WHO and the countries. I don't see other manufacturers can impact that because it is not a different product. It is, at this point, the exact same bag.
Well, definitely have to see how the other countries take hold of that moratorium. But moving on to the valuation of the company, I know that's an area that there's been a lot of attention in the past couple of months as you've pivoted from not just the COVID vaccine, but also to the rest of the pipeline. This is a new relationship. What do you think this boost in market valuation means about market sentiment towards mRNA technology?
I think if you look at the company, the company is, I think, on a great trajectory, and I think we're just getting started because, unlike other biotech company, we have a platform. You know, for the last 100 years with small molecule, every drug is different, and most drugs fail in the clinic because of safety issue. If you look at the world in which we are today, it's a world of information molecule like mRNA. In the case of Moderna, which I think is a quite unique situation because we don't have a partner, we keep all the profit of every asset. We have a very strong cash balance. We disclosed this morning, you know, $20 billion in APAs signed for this year, already $12 billion signed for next year, plus another $8 billion of options that countries have, and still many, many discussions. We are planning to double or triple our output of product next year. And this year, with less than $1 billion dose of supply, we're going to get to $20 billion of revenues. And so if you look at the profitability of a company, $2.8 billion of net income this quarter alone. If you just assume we don't grow the sales, which we are, because if you look at the sales so far in the year, it's $6 billion. We're saying $20 billion for the year. So it assumes a very strong ramp continuing, as we saw in Q4, Q1, and then Q2 now. And if you look at the cost line, it is not growing as fast as the top line. And even gross margin is improving. And so if you look at the earnings of a company, as you can see on the screen, 6.45, if you were just to multiply this number by four and look at the stock price, this is not a high PE. And Moderna is going to move from 21 being a prime vaccine company in 22 boosters. We say that our flu vaccine, which is in the clinic now, for which we're planning phase two and phase three already, could be launched as early as 23. And then you have RSV, which for which we get fast tracked by the FDA earlier this week, and then CMV. So if you look at the company where it's heading, I believe it is a very strong momentum. We also have, you know, six therapeutic in the clinic, in cancer, in cardiology, in autoimmune disease, in rare genetic disease. And now that we have a strong cash balance, we're increasing our investment. Today, we have 23 drugs in development, but could it be, you know, 40 drugs in development in the next 12 months? I think it's possible. Could it be 100 drugs in development in a few years from now? That's our plan. And so I think that what the market is like to realize is the company is not a one drug company. It's actually a platform.
Sorry, I think we lost him there, or if we can still hear me. I am curious about the FDA approval. I know you mentioned the FDA. So tell me about the approval, the full approval that you're looking for, about, because we know there's been a lot of focus on Pfizer right now and their full approval for the COVID vaccine. So I know you've already filed, but when do you, has there been any word on when you might get them?
So it's a big question on how long it will take the FDA to approve a vaccine. And I think the Pfizer approval is going to be a good indication for us. My understanding is Pfizer finished to file its BLA in July. We are reading in the media that it could be a late August, September approval. You know, I just told you we're going to finish our filing in August. So if it takes 1 month or a month and a half to Pfizer to get approved, I think a same order of magnitude for Moderna is possible. Again, it is not in our court. It's really for the FDA and the team to do the review. And this is very important. It's done thoroughly. It's a credibility of the agency that's on the line. It's a credibility of our vaccine. And so we really want this to be done as professionally as possible. And I trust the FDA to make sure this is done in such a manner.
Stefan, Zach here. Thanks for coming back on, man. Just wanted to ask one question as you're kind of walking through the revenue expectations there. As you said, expect the $20 billion for this year, and you got to see what happens in the next couple of years, but roughly on par. It is interesting to think about boosters and just kind of where we're at and the longer it takes to get the world vaccinated, the idea that you're going to continuously need more and more boosters to catch up to all these variants. I mean, when you look at that, how does Moderna as a company kind of, assess the sliding scale between everyone getting vaccinated now could solve a lot of these issues, but also kind of the added revenue that could come from the additional boosters farther and further down the line if we do see variants continue to pop up?
So we are making as many vaccines as we can. We announced, you know, new manufacturing investment. So we are not at all, you know, solving for let's not do too many vaccines. So the variant still evolving. This would be unethical. We are working as hard as we can to get as many doses as we can out. The virus is out of the bag. If you think about it, we're going to have to live with this virus like we have lived for most probably thousands of years with flu. There are more coronaviruses circulating in the population, like OC43, that get people hospitalized every year. So what we want to do is to make sure to get boosters so that people can live with this virus and have their life back again.
Moderna CEO Stéphane Bancel, always good to have you join us.
Moderna posting quarterly earnings today that beat on both the top and bottom line. The company also said its COVID-19 vaccine booster shot produced a, quote, robust antibody response against the highly contagious Delta variant, and that a third COVID-19 dose will be necessary probably prior to the winter season. Joining us now is Dr. Laxman Swamy, ICU physician at Cambridge Health Alliance and Boston Medical Center. Dr. Swamy, always good to see you. Thanks for being here. First off, just what do you make of the news we heard out of Moderna today regarding that booster shot?
You know, thanks for having me. I'm not that surprised, honestly. I think we've seen that things have certainly changed with Delta, and we've seen that there's more breakthrough cases. We're all hopeful that there's something we can do about that. And I'm optimistic that boosters are the way to go for that. When and how is, I think, still in question. I'd like to see some of the data kind of work its way through peer review and all of that and before really jumping on it. I don't think people should be so anxious to get another shot in their arms just yet, unless, of course, it's your first shot, and then you should be anxious.
I find it a little bit encouraging that folks are out there wanting to get a booster. I want to ask about the slowing pace of vaccinations that we are seeing right now. If you could just do a little bit of myth busting, I feel like we've all heard our armchair doctors out there giving us advice. So I want to talk to you, since you are a real medical professional, about this. Is the slowing pace of vaccinations and having these pockets of low vaccinated communities around the states enabling the virus right now to mutate into something that is more severe? So in essence, are some of these communities that aren't as well vaccinated, are they essentially weakening us as a country as a whole?
Unfortunately, I think that there is some reality to that, and I think it goes deeper than that. I think it's really a global phenomenon. Delta probably didn't originate in America, right? I think as far as we know, it probably came from India. And I think that's not going to be surprising until we have global control of the entire pandemic. We are truly all connected and in this together. So I think that it's true that patchy areas of lower vaccination rates can have an impact on everyone. And that's why, to put it together with this booster story, I think it's important to recognize that the vaccines already offer us a huge amount of protection. It's less than we hope for, probably, regarding Delta. But getting that booster dose for you, although it gives you a little bit more protection, the reality is that getting someone who's not vaccinated at all is going to give you and everyone else much, much better protection.
I want to bounce off that idea, Doctor, because earlier we actually had the Moderna CEO on. He spoke with our health reporter, Anjali Kamlani, and she talked to him about the World Health Organization calling on a moratorium of boosters in wealthier countries in order to help the rest of the world sort of catch up. Take a listen to what he had to say.
Every government has a mandate and wants to protect their citizens. So we cannot do much as a manufacturer, because if, you know, a country that you mentioned wants to use the current vaccine on hand, for which we shared the, you know, boosting per dose data, that is, again, the 42 times increase of antibodies versus after the second dose, we can do nothing to stop them.
It sounds like Moderna's hands are a bit tied, but Doctor, what do you think about the WHO's recommendation there regarding booster shots?
You know, I think that this is going to be, unfortunately, everything kind of coming to a head again, as we've seen many times, the sort of individual person's kind of attempt to get what they need, right? I need to kind of get my protection versus what will really give everyone the most protection is truly distributing those vaccines. That said, I think we have lots of vaccines available right now. And it's true if we started a massive campaign of boosters that would, you know, that would use up a ton of that stock. So I know that on a national and a global level, those decisions have huge impact. I think it's a tough point because the truth is that we've got to get more people globally vaccinated. That is way more powerful than getting boosters in arms right now.
Doctor, considering that globally we don't have a handle right now on this pandemic, should we be reconsidering some of our open borders right now, reconsider travel? Should Europe reconsider allowing American tourists to enter throughout these summer months? We recently have President Biden considering that all foreign travelers to the country will have to be vaccinated. Is that the policy that we should be implementing?
I think there's a lot of nuance in that policy because, first of all, we got to make sure that it's real when people are vaccinated. I think that's a valid concern. It's also important to say it's easy to say, let's keep everyone else out or let's not keep those borders open. But the reality is, as we've just talked about, there's so many pockets of low vaccination and unvaccinated people right here at home. So I think the danger is here regardless. And I think another challenge is that probably we're not out of this. We're not going to be out of this that soon. So these discussions about opening and closing borders, you know, I have family in Canada right now. We haven't seen them since this started. I'd love to make these things work, but the reality is all of these need to be played together in such a way. And the bedrock, the foundation, the cornerstone is just more vaccination to the unvaccinated.
And doctor, we know that those under 12 still cannot get vaccinated at the moment. And I saw a disturbing stat today that COVID-19 cases in children are up 84% in just the past week, with 72,000 kids testing positive for the virus. Hospitalizations are still very low and deaths are near zero. But what does that tell you about the virus and how we should be thinking about the return to school, which is going to be happening in the matter of weeks?
Yeah, it's coming up. And I work with our local public school on that as well. It's so challenging because we also know how much these kids have suffered from not being in school. And it's really hard to balance these together because no one, you know, I have three kids who are all under the age of 12. They can't get vaccinated anytime soon. And hopefully that changes for some of them. But, you know, it's a tense time. We have to figure out how to balance this. There's no zero risk situation. It is heartening that very few kids are getting hospitalized or dying. It's also terrifying that kids are getting hospitalized and dying. So, you know, children, just like anyone else, aren't statistics. We have to balance that, though, with the very real suffering and mental health damage that's happening when kids aren't in school. I think there are ways to open schools with significant support to improve the ventilation, to keep masking in place. I know, I hate to say it, but I think we need to do it right now. Keep masking and some element of distancing and improve the ventilation. I think there's a way to do that with a very high level of safety, as we've done here in my town.
Yeah, you know, it's very disheartening to see that Florida's governor is not mandating masks in schools. In fact, you got Arkansas's governor coming out and saying they regret not passing that similar mask ban recently. So, Dr. Swamy, always good to see you. Thanks for being with us. Elf Beauty had a pretty attractive Q1 earnings report. The cosmetics company topped earnings and revenue estimates, also raised its outlook for fiscal year 2022. Joining us now is Elf Beauty CEO Tarang Amin. Tarang, always good to see you. These are impressive numbers, albeit you are comparing them to the year of the pandemic, but net sales up 50% compared to a year ago, your 10th consecutive quarter of net sales growth. What drove those results for you at Elf?
Well, thanks for having me again. I would say it's continuation of our overall business model. We were strong entering the pandemic. We were strong throughout it, and I think we're even stronger now. And it fundamentally is about making the best of beauty accessible to every eye, lip, and face, and our strategy continues to work.
Now, I know that you're having a push right now to attract some younger customers, the Gen Z customers. How have the beauty trends changed for the Gen Zers compared to folks like myself that are millennials and even older?
Well, I think there are many commonalities. The love of this category in terms of new ideas and innovation, I think, resonates across all age groups. But we've had great success amongst Gen Z, really by our ability to engage them, by going on platforms like TikTok, being the first beauty company on Twitch and into gaming, really all the different ways that we engage. And we're now the second favorite brand among Gen Z in our space, and we continue to do really well amongst that group. And it's really about engaging.
Talk to me about some of the trends that you're seeing right now. What are consumers gravitating to, and has it changed during this pandemic?
Well, what we're really seeing is a strong inflection to the positive for the overall category. I think with all the restrictions we had last year, there's a lot of pent-up demand to be able to express yourself, to be able to get out there. In fact, June was the first month for the overall category that sales were above 2 years ago. And so we're definitely seeing consumers return to the category, and we're seeing for us strength across every one of our segments. We basically continue to build share, and we're the only top five brand really over a 2 year basis that's built a lot of share. And it's really because of the innovation that we have. We have products that really resonate with our consumers, and our ability to really engage them is the thing that continues to propel us.
What's your outlook as we come out of the pandemic? On the one hand, we are seeing folks leave their houses more and more often, folks willing to wear makeup to go to dinner, go to see their friends. But I'm also hearing from some of my friends actually say, listen, I haven't really worn makeup a lot throughout this pandemic, and I really like it. And now that I'm starting to leave my house again, I'm starting to rethink having to wear foundation and mascara and some other more traditional beauty items and makeup items. How are you perceiving this post-pandemic world that we're going to be in, particularly when it comes to purchasing makeup and other beauty items?
Well, I'm actually quite bullish on the category. As I mentioned, the category is coming back. We see a lot of consumer interest. And for e.l.f. in particular, I think we're well positioned. We have a very strong base in our core complexion products, our primers, our concealers, products that you don't actually have a full face of makeup to still make great benefits, as well as our growing skincare range. We have continued to have real strength across our skincare items, and that includes expansion of our brand portfolio. With the acquisition of Well People, a pioneering clean beauty brand that really appeals to consumers who are looking for much more conscious about the ingredients in their products, or our groundbreaking lifestyle beauty brand, Key Soul Care, that we developed with Alicia Keys. That's really about self-care, self-love, and rituals. That's really changing the scope of conversation in our space. So we're able to appeal to a broad set of consumers really through a robust portfolio that has momentum across every one of our brands.
Tarang, we talked to a lot of CEOs here who have been complaining about supply chain bottlenecks, and I'm wondering if you're experiencing the same thing there at e.l.f., and if inflation is starting to seep in, are you able to absorb those costs, or do you envision having to pass those along to the consumer in the weeks and months ahead?
Well, certainly we've been impacted like everyone else by the global imbalance of containers. I'm actually proud of our team of how we've been able to navigate that. In the quarter, our in-stock levels are 95%. That really talks to strength that we have with our retail partners and online. Certainly costs are elevated due to that, but you know, I consider that temporal in nature. I feel like over time, global imbalances tend to balance out, and I feel like we're really well positioned with the best combination of cost, quality, and speed in our space.
Tarang, I want to ask you about some of the ventures that e.l.f. has been going into, getting into gaming through a channel on Twitch. I see that there's also attempts to attract some Gen Z customers on TikTok. Tell us a little bit about that strategy.
Yeah, so our strategy is really to engage our consumers and find where they're most comfortable. So our foray onto TikTok, we're one of the first beauty brands on TikTok. Our latest challenge, TikTok Gamers Got Talent, generated over 17 billion views. So it's been remarkable the level of engagement we've been able to see on that platform. But similarly in gaming, it came from a simple insight that 70% of our consumers play video games. 65% of them watch others play video games on platforms platforms like Twitch and YouTube. And so it was a natural thing for us to do and really engage, and particularly our partnership with Lufu, the world's second largest gamer, female gamer, on empowerment, things that tie into our core values as a brand, we found is a great way of continuing to engage with our community.
Well, you have definitely found the secret sauce there, I think. Tarang Amin, CEO of Elf Beauty, congratulations again on those results, and thanks for being with us.